That was Cast Iron. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. If you like that, please feel free to tune in again at 8 p.m. on Fridays.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've worked hard all your life. Retirement worries shouldn't get in the way, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. But many Americans are finding that retiring on a fixed income is hard. BenefitsCheckup.org is a free website from the National Council on Aging. With just a few clicks, you can see if you qualify for thousands of dollars to pay for food, medicine, utilities, and more. BenefitsCheckup.org. You've earned this. This message is supported by the Administration for Community Living.
This journey from neoliberalism to neo-fascism is imminent in the situation of neoliberalism. If we are going to check the growth of neo-fascism, then we have to be prepared sooner or later to confront the hegemony of finance. Therefore, the struggle against finance is something which we have to be prepared to carry out. And I think it is that which is what underlies not only neoliberalism, but the turn that neoliberalism has taken towards neo-fascism in the more recent period.
That's Prabhat Patnaik, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Prabhat Patnaik, From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. Neo is a Greek prefix meaning new. Fascism of the classic variety is associated with Germany, Italy, and Japan. It ends at the conclusion of World War II. But in recent years, there's been a development of a different variety, which is called neo-fascism. From Modi's India to Erdogan's Turkey, neo-fascist autocratic regimes have taken hold. There's a direct connection from the failed economic policies of what is called neoliberalism to neo-fascism. Neoliberalism was given a huge boost in the 1980s by Reagan and Thatcher. Its characteristics are deregulation, cutting government spending, shredding the social safety net, privatization, and tax cuts for the rich. The result? Widespread immiseration and discontent. In its wake, demagogues exploiting the situation have come to power by scapegoating and instigating violence against minorities, coupled with loud calls for getting our country back and lots of flag waving. Our guest today is Prabhat Patnaik. He's an internationally renowned economist and professor emeritus at the Center for Economic Studies and Planning at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. He's the author of many books, including Monopoly Capitalism, and with his wife, Utsa Patnaik, of Capital and Imperialism. He spoke in New Delhi on January 24th. And now, Prabhat Patnaik.
The topic I chose to speak on is From Neoliberalism to Neo-Fascism. That's because of the connection between neoliberalism and neo-fascism, which is not much discussed. We think of neo-fascism, which currently is a tendency that is sweeping the world. We think of it as entirely a political phenomenon. But on the other hand, it has very deep political economy roots. And I think I would like to talk a little bit about the political economy roots. Neo-fascism, as you know, is very strong currently, whether it is Poland, whether it's Hungary, whether it's India, whether it is the United States, whether it's Britain, France, Germany, everywhere there is really a fairly strong neo-fascist upsurge. In some places, it is in power, but even when it's not in power, it is really a major political tendency. Now, the point is, I want to argue that this political tendency is something which has arisen as a sequel to the neoliberal process of development, neoliberal strategy of development, which has been again adopted all over the world. Now, I believe that the neoliberal strategy is one which essentially expresses or reflects the hegemony of globalized finance. That all over the world now, there is a tendency towards a globalization of capital, where capital from the north, from the global north, is now beginning to invest also in the global south. I should say that this is something that had never happened historically. For instance, in the colonial period, of the total British foreign investment that took place, anywhere in the world, only about 10% came to the British Empire. I mean, I'm talking about British Empire in the sense of the tropical British Empire. It went to the United States, Canada, and so on, but that's not something which I'm really concerned with. So typically, industry remained located in the north. It did not move south. While in the south, deindustrialization took place, whereby you actually had our artisans and so on being displaced, but nothing came to really take its place. Entrepreneurs started setting up industries. They faced very stiff tariff and other kinds of barriers in northern markets. So basically, the world got divided into a north that specialized in manufacturing and industry. And now that is now, at any rate, beginning to change under the current globalization. That now northern capital is beginning to set up industry in low-wage southern countries, whether it's China, whether it's Indonesia, whether it's Malaysia, whether it's Vietnam, and so on, and including other activities like services. India is a favorite destination for service activities. Now, therefore, you have a globalization of capital. But it is not only globalization of capital in production, you also have globalization, above all, globalization of capital as finance, as something that simply moves around. As a matter of fact, of the total cross-border flows of finance, only 2% are trade related. In other words, which involve the movement of goods of various kinds. Much of it is really purely finance, which is whizzing around the world, and it's whizzing around the world in search of speculative gains and so on. So globalization, above all, from the point of view of political economy today, entails globalization of finance. Now, notice one thing. If you have globalization of finance, but we live in a world of nation states. Now, therefore, it is a nation state, no matter whether the French state or the Indian state or the Polish state, facing globalized finance. In this situation, you have the nation state necessarily having to obey the dictates of finance. Because if you don't, then finance would leave your shores. Therefore, you have a situation where more or less all governments, no matter what their ideological complexion, even if tomorrow you had a socialist government coming to power in India, as long as it remains stuck in this process of globalized finance, namely finance can come in and go out at will, it will also necessarily have to follow the kind of strategy that globalized finance dictates. But the kind of strategy that globalization finance dictates is, in fact, the neoliberal strategy. Neoliberal strategy has a number of implications. We all know that, you know, can relatively free flow of goods, relatively free flow of finance, relatively free flow of capital, the withdrawal of the state from the public sector, and of course, complete freedom being given to the corporate financial oligarchy in every country, which is a part of this globalized finance, which is locked into this globalization process, globalization of finance, complete freedom to the corporate financial oligarchy, and so on. But it has some implications, which of course are analytically very important from my point of view as I'm going to develop the argument. One implication is that it wants a withdrawal of the state. The neoliberal policies necessarily want a withdrawal of the state from a whole range of supporting roles that in the state used to have vis-a-vis petty production, vis-a-vis small-scale production, and so on. And this is so everywhere. You know, in the name of controlling the kind of, you know, fiscal balance, in the name of cutting down fiscal deficit, in the name of reducing taxes for the corporate financial oligarchy so that they manage to make more investment, you cut down expenditure. And when you cut expenditure in the kind of expenditure the government used to incur in supporting the petty production sector, including peasant agriculture. The withdrawal of the state from supporting petty production and peasant agriculture is one of the hallmarks of neoliberal policy. We know what it means. We know with thousands of kisans outside the borders of Delhi, we can actually see this. But this is something which is not just an aberration. This is something which is a part of the neoliberal policies. It's just the fact that many previous governments have been really chary of following this policy to its limit. While the current government is one that really follows it. But the point is that the demand for state withdrawal of support from peasant agriculture is and from petty production generally is a demand that is really a hallmark of neoliberal policies. Now, one implication of this is that naturally, if you have peasant agriculture has been sustained through has survived because of this kind of government support, you know, for a variety of reasons. World prices fluctuate a great deal as far as agricultural commodities are concerned. Unless the government comes to sustain the peasantry in periods of price crashes, then of course they would get into debt. And when they get into debt, then over a period of time, they lose their land, they lose their livelihoods, and so on. So because of the withdrawal of government support from peasant agriculture, above all, there are three or four very clear ways of withdrawal of support that I can immediately cite to you. Earlier, we had, you know, now, for instance, minimum support price, procurement price, and so on, all of which sustain the peasantry against price crash.